the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World here in Las Vegas, where it's almost 113 degrees. That was Syreeta singing Sunny, and nobody sings Sunny or Corcovado better than Syreeta, and one night I'll have to introduce the show by having her sing Corcovado, which she does also in Portuguese. And then the other voice, of course, was the one and only, the standalone Frank Sinatra, the night in the late 70s when he took over from Johnny Carson, who was not a fan of mine. And the first guest that Sinatra booked was myself to do a stand-up, which you can see if you go to YouTube or John Barber's World and Google it. Anyway, tonight, it's just after 5 o'clock here in Las Vegas. They have just opened the Democratic Convention, and I swear, when I tuned in, I thought they were going to say, "From Philadelphia, it's Saturday Night Live." I just can't believe it. In Las Vegas, the flags over all over town are still at half-mast in observance of the Democratic Convention, as you can see tonight and all week, and you've been reading about. America now has four dysfunctional political parties. Two of them are Democratic and two of them are Republican. But I've got to tell you, the best joker comment I've heard from anyone about Hillary and her Spanish-speaking running mate Tim Kaine came from a friend on Facebook. His name is Nathan Anthony, and Nathan often writes very funny stuff that goes relatively unnoticed, except by me, because I love it. It's very Mark Twainish and Will Rogers. Anyway, yesterday he said, quote, "This may be the first time in history a presidential candidate and running mate will be lying to us in two languages." That is so good. Well, you know, Hillary herself must have gone to the same surgeon as Bruce Jenner, because she does have balls. I mean, just announcing that she's hiring Debbie Wasserman Schultz to help run her campaign. Now, Debbie doing Bernie, proving she can kill hope and change, is the perfect audition for our Lady Macbeth, who just seems to like to go around continuing to kill people. Now, you've all heard some celebrities and some friends of yours say, if either Trump or Hillary gets in, they're leaving the country. Well, folks, it's too late. If the Constitution and Bill of Rights are supposed to be the foundation of our country has already left them. And what is this today, all day long, all this unbelievable nonsense from Democrats wringing their hands over the party not being united? United over what? Hillary, the perpetual warmonger and one of the murderers of Muammar Gaddafi? And Bernie, the Democrats' Ron Paul and his cowardly bullshit about a political revolution now backing the bitch? The Democratic Party of FDR and JFK is as non-existent as is any real challenge to the military, banker, security, consumer, perpetual war state wrecking the world that is the USA. I've said many times, folks, I truly hate to swear, except on a golf course, but watching America's disintegrating democracy forces me to. Jesus Christ! any idiot of any persuasion can see by the building of massive barricades in Philadelphia that the 1% are trying to keep the 99% of us from making this a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And if anybody said that today, they'd be shot. It seems as though, without any real resistance from the people, America has evolved into the Fourth Reich. And who better to talk about the evolution from the Third Reich into the Fourth Reich than our amazing guest? She teaches philosophy at the University of San Francisco and often has put her body where her beliefs are. In the 80s, she spent half a year in war-torn Nicaragua, writing letters from Nicaragua. In the 90s, she spent months in Africa, teaching and writing in a non-apartheid newspaper, and published recently a great book called Cruel and Unusual, How Welfare Reform Punishes Poor People. And now, an even better, truly disturbing book, because it is true and it is disturbing to read these truths in this remarkable book. It's called American Nuremberg, subtitled The Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-911 War Crimes, Rebecca Gordon. Rebecca, thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure
to be with you.
And I must tell you, lucky you being in San Francisco. Oh, my God. But I must tell, which is probably, is supposed to be a more progressive and liberal town, but I think they're all sort of diminishing in America. But it was two or three of my friends on Facebook, whom I have a little contact with, they send me notes once in a while, but they've urged me for weeks to have you as a guest because they bought and read your book. So thanks to them and thanks to you. First, though, Rebecca, a little bit about your background, your childhood, your teenage years, your family, and what turned you into this wonderful political agitator and muckraker? Because I'm sure you didn't start out that way.
Well, nobody starts out that way. But I grew up in Washington, D.C., and I'm not literally a red diaper baby. My parents were not in the Communist Party or any party. They were too much. My dad was an actor and an artist, and my mom was enough of an iconoclast that she was not going to be anybody's party faithful. But I was raised to be aware of what was going on in the world. And growing up in Washington, D.C. in the 1960s, I was aware not only of what was going on in the federal government, but also the fact that I lived in a deeply divided city, the majority of whom were African American, and the whole city was run by Congress in those days. We had no elected city government whatsoever. Everything was run by the Dixiecrats in the Senate and House district committees, and they could not have cared less what happened to the black population of the city. So some of the worst slums in the country were literally four or five blocks away from the White House. And my mother worked for a local anti-poverty organization that was part of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty and the old Model Cities program. And I grew up with folks in my house who later on went on to be members of the elected government of Washington, D.C., for what that was worth. And I remember during the riots in 1968, after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, there was a pall of smoke all across the horizon in my city. And we lived in a part of the city that was very comfortable, very white, very middle class. But my mother had friends in the rest of the city, and my brother got home from school a little earlier than I did one day, and he walks into the living room, and there are two guys sitting in the chairs in the living room with rifles on their knees who had been sent to protect our house in case the people decided to march from the poor places to our neighborhood to let people know that our house was not to be touched.
Wow.
So that's the sort of growing up I had. My mom, we started out in D.C. because my mom got a job with the Peace Corps, but she quickly decided that the Peace Corps, and in those days it was being used very blatantly as part of the whole CIA apparatus, and she was in charge of the department that selected volunteers. And she started getting the word that in addition to these idealistic young college graduates, she had to accept these 30-something burly guys who didn't look like her idea of any kind of volunteer.
Oh, my. You know, that's the, you know, one would expect that. I mean, this, with Project Mockingbird created in the 50s, they infiltrated the media by the thousands, according to Frank Church in the 70s hearings at the end of the CIA. Mm-hmm. They discovered 1,000 of them. And you would think that, of course, that the Peace Corps might be a place that the CIA would insert infiltrators, but that's the first time I've ever heard of it, and frankly, the first time I ever thought of it.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. And years later, when I was living and working in Nicaragua, one of my fellow members of Witness for Peace had been a volunteer in Guatemala for 6 years, and he worked with indigenous, small indigenous villages and worked on beekeeping cooperatives. And every 6 months or so, they would go into Guatemala City and give a report on their work. And he said there was always some guy in the back who was never introduced, but who would stand there and take notes during all of the reports. And when I got to know him, he was a very, very bitter man because every single village where he had worked had been completely destroyed by the Guatemalan military, and all the people that he had worked with were murdered. And he realized that in his own way, he had been responsible for providing the information that led to their deaths. So
you know, it would,
it's very real.
It would lead one to believe... I remember during the House Select Committee hearings into the assassination of Martin Luther King and John Kennedy, Robert Tannenbaum was interviewing the fella, I believe his name was Phillips, David Attlee Phillips, who was in charge of the Western Hemisphere operations for the Central Intelligence Agency, played a major part in Guatemala and Iran and overthrowing their governments.
Mossadegh,
yeah, and they and Tannenbaum said that he now it's a subpoena that brings Phillips into the House Select Committee, and in the middle of the interview, Phillips gets up and literally goes home, and Tannenbaum rushes to the Justice Department and says he wants this guy arrested for obstruction of justice, and then. And defying a subpoena from Congress, and neither Congress or the Justice Department did anything. So Tannenbaum quit, and I believe he made the observation the reason that Phillips was so comfortable in not being charged was that the USA was now the CIA. And the more you look at what has happened to our country, the more you can believe that just dreadful, dreadful observation. Okay, now you go to school. Where did you go to college? Where did you go
I went to undergrad school in Oregon to a school called Reed College. And
Named after John Reed?
No, not exactly.
Okay.
Named after one Samuel Reed.
It was
an odd place. It's a small liberal arts school. It later on became the place where a lot of the early work on Macintosh programming was done. When I was there, they used to call it a little graduate school. And, you know, I majored in religion, and I was going to be a physics religion major, but I couldn't type, so none of my computer programs ever ran. And when I got out of college with my shiny new religion degree, the first job I was able to get was putting ice cream cones in boxes 8 hours a day in an ice cream cone factory. So I did that for a while, and then I worked for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, selling liquor in a liquor store, and sort of bumped around for a number of years doing different kinds of office work, and I discovered that they paid you extra if you ran a 10-key calculator instead of a keyboard, and so I became an accounting assistant, and eventually a friend actually took me under her wing, taught me to do bookkeeping, And for a period there, I actually, while living in San Francisco, was a nonprofit accountant. And I used to be the controller at a foundation called the Tides Foundation. And I was in charge of knowing where millions of dollars were. And it was all very, very interesting. But
what was the first article that you wrote, the thing that prompted you to speak out on your own? Do you recall it?
It's hard to remember, but I would say probably I was part of the lesbian community and the women's liberation community in Portland, Oregon, and I started a newspaper there that was called Ragtime, and we came out monthly.
Pardon me, but that's funny.
No, that was the name, and it was monthly. You can take from that what you like. I wrote a bunch of articles for that, and then my partner and I ran a newspaper with two other women for 12 years that was called Lesbian Contradiction, a Journal of Irreverent Feminism. And I wrote a lot of articles for that, including articles in which I was trying to educate or invite members of whose entire political outlook was focused on radical feminism to consider some economic and racial analysis and some ways of thinking about the world that were a little bigger than the idea of simply creating women-only communities. And so when I went to Nicaragua, I wrote about that. I wrote an article early on called What is Fascism? To try to encourage women to be able to understand what fascism had been as a political movement and to be able to think about what it would look like if we were to encounter it here in the United States, as we are doing at the moment.
I remember D.A. Jim Garrison saying that fascism will come to America in the guise of patriotism. But let me, this may sound like a silly question to you, but because of your sexual orientation, have mm-hmm. you found that some people do not respond to the truths that you tell in your writings because of that? I mean, wasn't it Marshall McLuhan who said the medium is the message? And then your medium
might be hard to swallow.
Yes.
I think that's possible. I will say that things are different now than they would have been, you know, 15, 20, 30 years ago. You know, I come from the generation of radicals who could not understand why my gay leaders thought the two things I wanted most in the world were to join the army and get married.
And Rebecca, Cruel and Unusual is just wonderful stuff. How welfare reform punishes the poor people. But something that must have scared you a little was to write mm-hmm. your recent book.
Yes.
To say the names out loud, and to put them in print. American Nuremberg, the officials who should stand trial for post-911 war crimes. What prompted you to write that? And it could not have been an easy choice for you to make.
No. Well, what happened was very interesting. I'd written an earlier book called Mainstreaming Torture, which is about torture in the post-9/11 period, and parts of it are historical and look back at the at MK Ultra and the CIA torture research program of the 50s and 60s. Part of it, but it's an academic book, and it was written for an academic audience. Although it's actually written for a general audience, but it comes from Oxford University Press, so it looks like an academic book, and it's about not only how the U.S. has both continued its trajectory of using torture, but also the changes in public conversation about torture that happened after September 11th. And after I wrote this book, I went on the radio a lot. And one day, David Talbot, who wrote Season of the Witch and The Devil's Chessboard, which is a new book about the Dulles brothers,
right,
and they're involved, right?
Very good book, by the way.
Yes, very good book. He heard me on the radio, and he sent me an email, and he said, I have a book I want you to write, and here's the title, American Nuremberg.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
And I said, oh, well, nobody's ever asked me to write a book before. And at first, I was not comfortable with the title, and I'll tell you why. My dad was raised in an Orthodox Jewish home. He fought in World War II. I was raised to understand that, in a sense, the crimes of the Nazi regime were in some way historically unique in the world, that they were of a scale that was so unimaginable. And, you know, when you think about how many people died in World War II, it's somewhere between 45 and 55 million people, just in Europe alone.
25 million in Russia.
Right, exactly, just Russia. Another 25 to 30 million people in Asia. So we're talking somewhere upwards of 80 million people. And then I look at the horrors of the U.S. so-called war on terror, and there's a sense in which the scale, horrible as it is, the scale is just very different. So I was uncomfortable with the title, but as I started to relearn about the story of the original Nuremberg trials, I realized that something very important actually happened at Nuremberg, which is that for the first time in history, countries came together and said in a public and legitimate way, although there were, you know, critiques that could be made of Nuremberg, but that crimes, war crimes, are real crimes. Crimes that break international laws are real crimes and have real consequences. And the effort to put together the tribunals, the work that had to be done among the four great powers who were already getting ready to face off against each other by 1945 when the tribunal began. You know, the United States had already dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, partly as a so-called message to the Japanese, but also obviously as a demonstration to the Soviet Union.
Rebecca, that is all true, but at the same time that the Nuremberg trials were going on, we were implementing Operation Paperclip, which was recruiting Nazi war criminals.
And there's no question about that. My book does not talk much about that, but it mentions it, but it's absolutely true. And, you know, there was a fair amount of hypocrisy involved. So, for example, when they started thinking about what kinds of crimes they were going to try the Nazi officials for, one thing that was not included was the Blitz, you know, the air war against the civilian population of England, which was a terrible and was a war crime. But they knew that if they were to do that, it would invite the criticism that the Allies had, you know, done firebombing. The most famous in Europe is Dresden.
But what
is less well known is that in the months leading up to the end of the war, the U.S. firebombed 50 cities in Japan. And those cities, about 500,000 people died in those firebomb attacks. Those cities were almost entirely wood and paper construction, and they were just burned to the ground.
Okay,
and
Rebecca,
so,
now you've written the book, okay?
I've written the book.
You don't like the title, but now you have to
start.
But
I've written the book.
Okay.
So,
what is the first name you picked?
It was a toss-up, right? It was a toss-up between George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And the question is, which one do you think was running things? So,
well, it would be Dick Cheney. It would be
That's what most people think. And
And
the other thing that became really clear, and this again harkens back to the Nuremberg trials, the first crime that they tried the Nazis for, and people don't remember this, it wasn't crimes against humanity, it wasn't straight up war crimes. The very first crime was what they called the crime against peace. And the argument that the United States and Britain made, ironically, because you'll see why in a minute, was that it was this crime of invading countries, of making unprovoked and aggressive war, invading Poland, invading Czechoslovakia, later invading France, that out of these crimes, all the other Nazi crimes arose. And you might think, you know, oftentimes when people think about the Holocaust and the murder of 6 million Jews and of all the other groups who were targeted in the Holocaust, the reality is most of those people did not die in Germany. They died in Poland.
Yes, they did.
And so as I was thinking about the crimes of the Bush, Cheney, and Obama administrations, what became really clear to me is that the primary crime, the crime out of which even the torture first sprang, was the illegal, unprovoked war against Iraq. The war against Afghanistan, I still also think, was illegal.
That's the breaking of the peace that you're talking of.
Exactly. The breaking specifically of the Kellogg-Briand Treaty, which the United States signed and ratified.
So that means you had to pick heads George Bush?
Heads George Bush or tails Dick Cheney. And the way it works is that in each chapter, I describe a kind of crime and I give some pretty gruesome examples of those crimes. And then I, throughout the chapter, name all of the people who were responsible for that kind of crime. And then at the end of each chapter, I list them all. So there's a set of lists in there. And then at the end of the book, I list the 22 most egregious criminals. And these include mostly government officials, but they also include two contractors for the CIA, a man named James Mitchell and a guy named Bruce Jessen, who were psychologists who were contractors. They designed the CIA's interrogation program. They designed waterboarding, and they actually engaged in experimentation on people who had been detained by the United States in order to see what kinds of torture were most effective. And this, of course, is a war crime.
America's Minglers.
Yes, exactly. And they got $81 million from the CIA for their company for doing it. And we are still on the hook, by the way, until 2021 to pay their legal fees.
Okay, now I presume now you have George Bush. Give me a couple of reasons now. Along with him, you would have to include maybe Cheney, then Condoleezza Rice, then Colin Powell.
Colin Powell, he gets a bit of a pass from me just because he was cut. The documents that are available to us show how many times he was cut out of the loop.
But his presentation at the United Nations of that fake file is criminal.
Oh, absolutely criminal. And all of the stuff about, you know, there was a weekend when they all went on Meet the Press. Dick Cheney and Myers, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Condoleezza Rice, and they all had the same line, which is, we can't wait for the smoking gun for the weapons of mass destruction to be a mushroom cloud. Right.
Yes, Condoleezza Rice. That's a very famous quote.
Absolutely.
And shame on the masters in Augusta, Georgia, for admitting her as a member. And shame on Stanford for hiring her.
Or having her back. Yes, I completely agree. And of course, I don't live that far away from. And what she really wants is to be the head of the NFL. She wants to be the commissioner of the NFL, the National Football League. That is her actual desire. But, yes, so Condoleezza. Then there are the attorneys. So there's John Rizzo, who was the chief counsel for the CIA, who spent all his time desperately attempting to establish an ass-covering paper trail that showed that the CIA had approval to do all the things that they were doing, all of the interrogations, all of the torture. It includes John Yoo and Jay Bybee, who wrote the famous memos that approved torture, the one in which John Yoo wrote that his interpretation of the U.S. anti-torture statute, which was written to put into effect the Convention Against Torture, which the U.S. signed and ratified, his famous memo said that severe pain or suffering, in order to be bad enough to fit the law's definition, would have to be so bad that it was the kind of pain that would usually be associated with organ failure or even death. In other words, he didn't die, you didn't torture him.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
So you should know, he, by the way, now has an endowed chair at the University of California at Berkeley yes. Law School, and Jay Bybee is now a federal judge.
Now,
so they have not suffered
speaking of judges, though, there this country must have a few dozen judges who legally would agree with the edicts laid down by the jurors at Nuremberg, that there are war crimes, and looking at what you say in your book and what a lot of people observe is true, we are run by a bunch of war criminals. Why is it that no kind of action could be taken by the United States? Now, I understand, I don't know if this is true, I've read it a couple of times, that there is a warrant out for the arrest of Henry Kissinger because of his participation in the murder of Salvador Allende in Chile, and that he will not travel there. I've heard rumors that Bush will not go to Europe because he's afraid somehow The Hague has some cops that might arrest him. Why?
He was supposed to. So let me talk about that a little bit. It can't be The Hague. And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
So there is a court that is sort of the successor court to the Nuremberg Tribunal. It took 50 years to create it, but it's called the International Criminal Court, and it's located in The Hague. And the U.S. originally signed the treaty that created this court. But then the Bush administration in 2002 wrote to The Hague and said, we're taking back our signature, and furthermore, it was never ratified by the Senate, so it never became part of U.S. law. But then Congress actually passed a law making it illegal for anybody in the United States to cooperate with that court in bringing any U.S. citizen to trial there. And not only that, this law actually says that if by some accident some U.S. citizen ends up on trial in The Hague at the International Criminal Court for war crimes, the U.S. military must be mobilized to rescue that person. Some people, we call
God,
it the Invade The Hague law.
It sounds like a Stanley Kubrick, Peter Sellers movie. But
doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
I mean, we're in Dr. Strangelove territory.
Rebecca, does this put you sort of in jeopardy? Because it's almost as though you're encouraging citizens' arrests of known war criminals. But if that should happen, you could be arrested yourself.
Well, you know, I don't worry. I think I'm a pretty small fish, to tell you the truth. Now, my partner and I did find ourselves on the no-fly list back in 2002, we were going back east to visit my father, and we had 1,000 copies of a newspaper called Wartime Tiempo de Guerra, which was a paper we were working on that suggested that there was some other possible response to September 11th besides going to war all over the world. And we got up to the airport, we got up to the counter, and they told us we were on the FBI no-fly list. They called the police. They detained us for about half an hour, and eventually they called into headquarters to see if we were on a master list, and we ended up not being. But the whole thing was crazy because my father's girlfriend had a brother who was a reporter on the San Francisco Chronicle. So as soon as he heard about it, he said, well, would they talk to a reporter? And we said, oh, yeah, we'd talk to a reporter. And so the story went all over the place. And then it happened. My partner was doing some contract work for the Northern California American Civil Liberties Union. And they said, oh, would you like to be plaintiffs in a Freedom of Information Act suit to try to find out how they're putting these lists together? And we said, oh, sure, we'll do that. And the truth is that in the end, we were never able to find out how we got on the list, but the federal judge did say that we had a right to know the names of the individuals who were responsible for the list because they were our public employees, and they awarded the ACLU $200,000 in court costs. So it was a pseudo win. It was something of a win.
Did any of that money come to you, and did you learn the names?
Oh, no.
Did you learn the names of the people who turned you in?
No, we never did. And it's not, and, you know, the truth is, I have no idea why we were on that list. But, you know, given that it was both of us and that we worked on the paper and were two of the people who founded it, all of which is to say, I think, as a middle-class white lady who teaches at the University of San Francisco, which is a well-respected Jesuit school, And with this sort of history of, you know, having already once been at least annoyed by the federal government, I feel like I am at much less risk than many other people in this country. I'm at way less risk, say, than my friend Alicia Garza, who's one of the founders of Black Lives Matter.
I think
that I am, you know, a relatively safe person.
Well, so I must tell you, your writing is unsafe. It is absolutely wonderful. Where can people go to get
my book? Well,
yes.
They can get it at, you know, that big online place that is named after a river in South America. They can get it at Barnes & Noble. It's also available electronically, and I recorded personally the Audible version. So if people like audiobooks, you can get it from audible.com. You can also get it from your local independent bookstore, and if they're not carrying it, you can encourage them to start carrying it, or your local public library. I'm a deep, deep believer in libraries.
Have you been on Len O'Sonic's show, Black Op Radio, out of Vancouver?
No, but I would love to.
First of all, he would love you as a guest. He has the best internet show about the assassination of John Kennedy, on which I've appeared a number of times. But he listens only to audiobooks, and I'm going to order your book for him. I'm going to give it
him
as a gift, because he will absolutely love it. And when you get back from your trip, I know you're leaving San Francisco to go where? Tell us where you're going and what you're doing.
I'm going to Massachusetts. It could be a whole lot worse. My stepmother lives on Martha's Vineyard Island. That's her home, and that's where I'm going to help take care of her. And that's a very beautiful place off Cape Cod, so it could be a lot worse.
Are you going by bus or driving?
Am flying.
You're back on?
I am able to fly. Okay. I am able to fly.
Well, also, would you be able again in a month or two to come back and do the show?
I'd be delighted. And this is, you know, this I can do it wherever I am. I'm not on duty 24/7. So yes, I'd be delighted.
Okay. And if you have a chance there in San Francisco, my cohort on the show, Joe Satilli, writes the very best daily newsletter in America. It's called News Vandal. He doesn't live. Doesn't live or work too far from you. And if you're up to it for the next 20 or 25 minutes of the show, stay tuned and listen to Joe, because he is absolutely brilliant. And I want to thank you so much, Rebecca, for being here. I want to thank my Facebook friends for recommending you. And I'm going to get the audio version from my friend Len O'Sonic. You fly safe, and we're going to talk to you again in another month or so, okay?
Excellent. Thank you so much, John. Take care.
Thank you, Rebecca. Fly safe. Bye-bye, dear. Bye-bye. We'll be right back with Joe Satilli.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World, every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
This is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific and I'd say historic film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World. I want to thank Richard Belzer. I also want to thank George Knapp for that wonderful unsolicited review of The Last Word on the Assassination, which you can get up on Amazon. You can go up there and read 100 wonderful unsolicited reviews. Also, and if you happen to buy it or download it, you can download it for just a couple of dollars. But every penny goes to the making of part two of the Garrison tapes, which is called The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And you heard Rebecca Gordon talking about the infiltration by the CIA of the Peace Corps. Well, it's nothing compared to how they infiltrated and literally took over the media in the United States and continue to do so. The documentary, believe me, folks, is going to be the godfather of American documentaries, and playing a major role in putting it together with me as my guest and cohort here, Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome to the show again. I guess you're in a relatively cooler San Francisco.
Yes, actually, I live on the island of Alameda. It's just off of the coast of Oakland, nestled in the bay between San Francisco and Oakland. So, yes, there's a nice cool breeze. It's wonderful. I actually grew up in a place called Livermore, which is famous for Lawrence Livermore Nuclear Laboratories and also wine. You know, I guess they go together, wine and bombs. At least one makes the other a little bit more tolerable. So it's a very, very warm place out there, and I have to go out there periodically into that heat, which is not quite Las Vegas heat or desert heat, but, you know, California is a coastal desert, and Livermore is an example of that. And I personally can't tolerate it, and I don't know how, as the years progress, and with each passing year, it's getting hotter, and the heat waves are getting bigger, and they're affecting places more acutely. You know, we had a temperature of, I believe it was 138 degrees Fahrenheit registered in Iran about 2 months ago. Oh, and there are heat waves happening in India and in Pakistan that are not being reported on here in the United States because, oh, by the way, one of the major party candidates believes that climate change is actually a plot, a conspiracy plot concocted by the Chinese to destroy American industry, because, you know, that's what the Chinese, they definitely don't want
they
us.
All they have to do is reelect another Clinton and help destroy American industry for crying out loud.
So there is that, but,
speaking of that, from Philadelphia, Saturday Night Live. The first thing I read on the news vandal today, and I couldn't believe it, was this possible major story about the WikiLeaks stuff about Debbie Wasserman Schultz sabotaging Bernie, and then Hillary being interviewed by 60 Minutes and denying knowing anything about this.
No, John, she hasn't read, she hasn't heard, she doesn't know anything, she doesn't know. Her internal server has been wiped clean.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like Bill saying, I never had sex with that woman. It's Hillary saying, I never had lies with that woman. So the fact that 60 Minutes does not broadcast in any way, probably the most interesting and exciting part.
You have to. That is journalistic malpractice. You ask a direct question about an important scandal or political crisis, because it was developing as a political crisis when they went to air yesterday on 60 Minutes, and you don't show her basically refusing to answer the question. That's the bare minimum of what you should do, it seems to me. Now, they did put it on 60 Minutes Overtime, which is, you know, online, and if you want to go onto the internet and find it. And, of course, Weekly Standard, which is Bill Kristol, the famous neocon, his magazine, they went and found it, and I said, okay, well, let's put it on today's newsletter. But you have to at least show the question and show her non-answer, it seems to me. You know, they did a great job with Trump and Pence in the prior week showing all of the inanity. I mean, it was basically Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy if Edgar Bergen was a terrible ventriloquist. It was comical.
I saw the cartoon you put up. It was just fabulous. The Photoshop. It was great.
Here's to the point of the emails. And, you know, I haven't gone through, I haven't begun searching the 20 plus thousand emails that WikiLeaks has dumped. I'm looking at all of the, here's the 10 worst or the 6 worst or the most important. And I've looked at all of those. And really what I haven't seen anything that shows a distinct pattern of direct subterfuge to destroy the Bernie Sanders campaign. What you see is the tip of the iceberg, the almost happenstance way in which it is the Bernie campaign's talked about as something, as a burr in their side or something that needs to be managed or ignored or sequestered off into a different part of the political process. What I do find in the emails that I've read and in the stories that I've read about the emails is that there is a troubling pattern of the media consulting with the Clinton campaign about stories about the Clinton campaign. One in particular, Kenneth Vogel, who is a lead political reporter for Politico, submitting a story to the Clinton campaign before he submits it to his editor for comment. I mean, this is, you know, there's journalism and there's journalism. This is journalism.
Oh, my God. That's reprehensible.
Yeah. And this is where the problem comes in. And if you think about it, what Trump's strategy was in his week-long reboot of the Reagan Revolution, because that's what I'm calling it. I believe he's rebooting the Reagan Revolution with, you know, like Hollywood reboots old movies with lots of explosions and you just add more sex and all of a sudden you got, you know, the Gipper on steroids, because that's really what Trump is. You know, he attacks the media incessantly. And here is case in point for his supporters to go, see, the fix is in. The media is rigged in favor of Hillary Clinton. And when he says that Bernie Sanders got a raw deal and Bernie Sanders faced a rigged system, it all fits in perfectly. And I'm telling you, this guy, Trump, when it comes to today's media political environment, he's crazy like a fox. As a matter of fact, he's crazy like a former Fox chairman, because he's bringing in Roger Ailes to help him with.
Yes. Do you know that Roger, when I was under contract to Westinghouse to replace Merv Griffin, and at the time I was doing my act at the Fremont Hotel downtown, I was the opening act for John Gary. Roger Ailes was assigned by Westinghouse to be my producer.
Now, that's fascinating to me.
Now, he came out to the Fremont Hotel and stayed for 2 days, watched my act. We had long conversations and long dinners. But the amazing thing to me, he must have been in his 20s at the time, about 5'10", maybe, slender, Cary Grant-ish looking. He had dark hair and it looked like he had dark eyes. He had movie star looks. You would not know that he grew into this person unless he lived on Orson Welles' diet.
He literally became Jabba the Hutt from Star Wars.
He did, and I write it in about it in more length in my book, but I would never recognize him. Never at all. So it is amazing. But Roger Ailes will help Donald Trump. And I mean, you even got baseball hat wearing Michael Moore predicting that Donald Trump is going to win because the Bernie people are so pissed at Hillary and Bernie that they're going to vote for Trump. Some of them, I know a lot of people will vote for Jill Stein and then a couple of other people. There are two guys whose name I can't remember. I featured their commercial on my Facebook page. It is the best political commercial I
have
ever seen.
Yeah, it's Gary Johnson and Bill Weld. Gary Johnson, former governor of New Mexico. Bill Weld, former governor of Massachusetts. And I've seen a couple specific polls, targeted polls, that show that Gary Johnson is actually the wild card that could make Trump president, which is counterintuitive because the idea is that a lot of Republicans will go to Gary Johnson. But it does look like Gary Johnson pulls from both Hillary and Trump. In other words, he is taking disaffected Democrats and Bernie supporters and pulling them in to his campaign, which is a very, very ominous
I am so glad you remembered who it was, because I must tell you, I have never seen a political ad as effective as the one that those two put together. And that includes anything that John Kennedy did or Lyndon Johnson or John Kerry or anybody. It is an absolutely wonderful Frank Capra-ish down-to-earth commercial for the two of them. And if it had more distribution, I don't know where it's seen. I've never seen it on the air. I've only seen it on the internet, and that's why I posted it. But, Joe, it is wonderful.
Well, I do remember the ad. The difficulty for like the Libertarian Party is one of, you know, it's funding. It's getting the money and getting the penetration into the television market, where Hillary Clinton is going to be spending hundreds of millions, if not tens of billions of dollars, right? Not tens of billions. I'm exaggerating. She's gonna spend hundreds of millions of dollars. This will probably be a $3 to $4 billion campaign by the time it's done. So I don't want to say tens of billions.
Wouldn't it have been wonderful? Now, a year and a half ago, I predicted that Bernie Sanders, I was afraid, would turn out to be the Democrats' Ron Paul. Wouldn't it have been wonderful if people had been forewarned enough so that then when they made a contribution to Bernie Sanders, they would say, you get to keep this money if you run either as an independent. Okay, you get to keep it. If you don't run as an independent and support the Democrats' nominee, then you must turn over the money to Gary Johnson.
Well, you know, John, what's interesting about this campaign to me is that Bernie Sanders, for example, did not read the tea leaves. Nobody read the tea leaves that this could have been the year for a Bernie Sanders to actually be a third-party candidate.
Exactly.
This is the one thing, the one service that I think Donald Trump has done to the Democratic process is to blow open the conventional wisdom, blow a hole in it as a huge hole. He's blown a gigantic hole in the establishment, the political establishment, and the notion that you cannot break the two-party system. It can be broken. And in many ways, what we're seeing play out right now is, if you juxtapose last week to this week, he broke the Republican Party. He actually broke it like a wild horse, and it by the end of that week, it was obeying his commands. What is not happening in the first day here in the Democratic Party convention is there's no sense that the Bernie Sanders, the Sandernistas, as they're often called, the Bernie Sanders voters, his supporters at that convention are going to come to heel, to use a term that Hillary Clinton used about supposed super predators back in 1996, I think it was. But he broke that party and he bent it and he turned it into his. Hillary Clinton, I think, has a much greater challenge in terms of doing that. I don't know that she can do it at this point.
She can't do it. Danny Glover, a former very close friend, is in Philadelphia right now. He wants to confront Bernie Sanders about why he's not running as an independent when obviously in America today now, because of Bernie Sanders, when all of this happened and all these people by the thousands showed up, he must have kept saying to himself, oh shit, where did they come from? But the thing is that there are more independents now, first time ever, than there are Republicans and Democrats combined. And as you said, it would have been a perfect time for him. Well, Danny used to do every one of my shows when I had a show in L.A. And bless him, he's spending his money and taking folks back there to challenge Bernie. And there are going to be thousands of them there. And I'm telling you, I would not be surprised if there are riots because Hillary Clinton is not liked. Bernie was liked, and there's nothing worse than being hurt and lied to by someone you like.
Well, the other thing is that he, if he has done what I think he may have done, he can't talk about it, and he can't, at least he can't talk about it yet, which is it, he negotiated a deal, obviously, with the Democratic Party, with the Clinton campaign, and I think that part of that deal that, it, you know, he lost some of his leverage, I believe, when he stayed in the race as long as he did. Had he exited a little bit earlier and with a little bit more magnanimity, he would have had more chips. Well, what has happened with the WikiLeaks scandal is that the cards he was holding went from being, you know, a pair to a straight flush. And right. Now he's holding the cards because this WikiLeaks scandal gave him a huge amount of leverage because of the impact it had with the supporters. And I believe that over the last 48 hours, he has been using that to, one, extricate Debbie Wasserman Schultz from the chair of the DNC. And I just
but
have
Hillary
a
– just hired her.
Hired her for a ceremonial position as it – I think that that's just a, basically a pillow landing for her to get her out of there. Because that was probably part of the negotiation.
But she's still part of the system if she's assisting Hillary. That's the horrible thing about
Hillary. Yeah, but you know what? Then there's Donna Brazile, and she was over at ABC, and the revolving door keeps going. Look, we're dealing – John, we're dealing with – you know what I call them? I call them big box Democrats. when Dukakis lost and – the Democratic Party was lost in the wilderness because of that loss. Bill Clinton came into that opening. He exploited it with his new Democrats. You know, the new Democrats were these pro Wall Street hawkish Democrats, and they completely remade the Democratic Party. Hillary Clinton was on the board of Wall Street before she was First Lady of the United States. And this big box Democrat style, which is pro-business and progressive, really what they are is actually the old Eastern establishment Republicans, socially liberal and pro-business.
Joe, with the WikiLeaks leaks, which gives this royal flush to Bernie Sanders, why would he not play those cards and bring charges in California where voter fraud is evident? They have found thousands of ballots.
Here's my operating theory right now is that he said today, I watched him when he was speaking, he said, Debbie Wasserman Schultz leaving opens the door to a new era in the Democratic Party, which to me, what I hear is I've negotiated getting her out. I'm going to get my people at the top of the DNC or near the top of the DNC, and we're going to have a multi-generational effect on the direction of the Democratic Party. We're going to have a takeover of the Democratic Party, and by the time we get 4 years down the road, our vision and our millennial support and our progressive view will actually become the standard in the Democratic Party. If that's what he's doing – look, Bernie Sanders can't do what Ted Cruz did. Ted Cruz took the bait and he went up there and tried to put a knife in the back of Trump because as far as Ted Cruz is concerned, he wants to run against Hillary Clinton in 4 years. That's his best case scenario. Bernie can't do that. So what Bernie wants to do, I believe, is effect a multi-generational shift inside the Democratic Party, away from the big box Democrats, back to the kind of liberal progressive policies that he was a champion of in the 60s.
Well, there's nothing in the Constitution or Bill of Rights about America having a two-party system.
No, there isn't. None.
And shame on Bernie Sanders with having more – he had more people show up than Trump and Hillary combined. Hillary couldn't put 400 people in a room. He could put 40,000 in a stadium.
She could put 400 people in a room, but it was only when she was speaking to Goldman Sachs.
That's very funny. And getting $250,000 for it. Yes, absolutely. Well, I am so disappointed in Bernie. I was more disappointed of Ron Paul because I had more hopes for Ron Paul since he had introduced legislation to halt or at least to look into the Federal Reserve, if not banish it, at least audit it. And he could not get anybody in the Senate or the Congress to co-sign a bill for him. So at least Bernie's never taken that step, you know, so I was disappointed in him. But I'm not as disappointed in Bernie because I predicted it about a year and a half ago.
Yes, you did, on this show, actually.
Yeah, but I must say...
Just know it's time.
Okay, I was thrilled at the fact that he drew so many people because I was not quite aware, through mainstream media's news reporting, that many Americans were aware of what lies they were being fed by the media and their government. Anyway, for more of your wonderful truth-telling, Joe, where can they go? Where can they see you and hear you again?
Just go to
news. I became a patron.
Yes, you did, and I appreciate it. And go to newsvandal.com, newsvandal.com. You can sign up there. A little screen will pop up. And in the upper right-hand corner, you can go to my Patreon link and become a patron just like John did for $10 a month. Help me get the News Vandal rundown out daily. And John, as always, it is my true honor to join you on every other Monday.
Oh, I just love having you here, Joe. You are by far the best. I also have the best producer in Mike Kim and the best possible place to be, BBS Radio, with run and owned by Don and Doug Newsom, Doug being our engineer tonight. I want to thank again Rebecca Gordon for being here. Thank you all for being here, and good night and good luck.
You're my spark of nature's fire. Desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.